The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
When it comes to the biggest security issues facing Americans, there's one podcast with the answers you need to keep you and your family safe.
Hate crime is something we need to take a more active role in mitigating.
CBS News Radio presents Security Matters with renowned global security expert Paul Violas. Paul tackles security issues like terrorism and cybercrime with the help of intelligence and law enforcement professionals.
Who better to go to than Chris Donahue from the FBI?
Security Matters with Paul Violas. Subscribe to the podcast today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Southern California shakes.
The quake's epicenter was in the Mojave Desert.
And the president's 4th of July spectacular.
We come together as one nation with this very special salute to America.
And now, from the Capital One Bank Studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Hope you're enjoying your long holiday weekend. Let's start in Southern California, where another strong earthquake hit.
Splashing pools and swinging chandeliers as a powerful earthquake jolted Southern California Friday night.
And all of a sudden, like, something started shaking, and we're, like, looking around, and all of a sudden, everyone's like, whoa.
The 7.1 magnitude quake was centered near Ridgecrest, the same location as Thursday's Tumblr. About 3,000 residents are without power. Crews responded to house fires.
We all started crying because we were scared, and then my brother was still in his room, and he was like, something's burning in her room, and then we all got backed away from the house, and then it just all lit up.
Friday night's earthquake was 10 times stronger than the one on the 4th of July, and damage is more significant near the epicenter.
My expectation is that Ridgecrest is having a pretty difficult time tonight.
A rock slide forced a highway closer near Bakersfield. Employees at a casino in Coachella Valley sprinted for cover in a restaurant. And the shaking could be felt as far away as Las Vegas, where a Pelicans and Knicks game had to be postponed.
In California.
Experts say given the size of the fault, there will likely be more shaking.
The expectation is we're going to have aftershocks tonight. It's going to continue on.
Crews will spend the day working to get a full assessment of the damage. Tom Foti, CBS News.
Now back here in Washington, where President Trump held his own event on the National Mall on July 4th as the U.S. flexed its military muscle.
With fireworks and controversy, President Trump celebrated America's 243rd birthday his way.
We come together as one nation with this very special salute to America.
The president's Salute to America 4th of July event in the nation's capital featured tanks and military vehicles, flyovers by the Navy's Blue Angels, pageantry and applause. All branches of the armed forces were on hand and hailed.
Our nation is stronger today than it ever was before.
President Trump's event generated days of advanced criticism from Democrats and others who accused him of politicizing Independence Day.
Dishonors our troops, dishonors our service members and veterans because it's really all about Trump.
It was marked by protests like this one Thursday in front of the White House. In his speech, President Trump ran through more than two centuries of iconic moments in American history.
Exactly 50 years ago this month, the world watched in awe as Apollo 11 astronauts launched into space.
In the audience, he honored Clarence Henderson, who took part in a sit-in at a Greensboro, North Carolina Woolworth lunch counter in 1960, a moment many say began the civil rights movement. Katherine Johnson, CBS News, Washington.
Before heading to his Bedminster, New Jersey golf club for the weekend, President Trump told reporters he'll continue to push to include a question about citizenship on the 2020 census, despite a Supreme Court ruling standing in the way.
We can start the printing now and maybe do an addendum after we get a positive decision. So we're working on a lot of things, including an executive order.
Also Friday, the Commerce Department released its latest jobs report, with the U.S. adding 224,000 non-farm jobs in June. The Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General is raising new concerns in a report on conditions at migrant detention centers. It says it found dangerous overcrowding and health and safety concerns. It's prompted protests across the country.
Love, not hate, makes America great. Across the country Tuesday, hundreds of people turned out for protests demanding migrant detention centers be closed.
We are collectively astounded and horrified at the cruelty that is going on at our border.
In its new report, the office says overcrowding is so bad, desperate detainees at one facility went so far as to clogging toilets with Mylar blankets and socks in order to be released from their cells during maintenance. Investigators also say they observed overcrowding at facilities where children are being held and that many are being held longer than legally allowed. At three facilities they visited, investigators say children had no access to showers, and at two facilities, no access to hot meals. This video of a 12-year-old migrant girl speaking to her immigration attorney about the alleged conditions of the Border Patrol facility in Clint, Texas, is where she was held for 12 days. They gave us little food. Some children did not bathe, the girl said in Spanish. They were mean to us. The Department of Homeland Security acknowledges the findings in this OIG report and calls what's happening here along the southern border an acute and worsening crisis. The House Oversight Committee has called an emergency hearing for next week where they will address the findings of this report. Mireya Villarreal, CBS News in McAllen, Texas.
A Navy SEAL was acquitted by a military jury of killing an ISIS soldier Tuesday following an unusual trial.
Thank God, and my legal team and my wife.
Navy SEAL Chief Edward Gallagher says he's grateful he's been exonerated for the most serious charges against him. He walked out of military court Tuesday with his wife Andrea by his side.
I was feeling like we're finally vindicated after being terrorized by the government that my husband fought for 2 decades in the war on terror.
During Gallagher's 2-week trial, 7 SEALs from his platoon testified that he stabbed an ISIS captive in Iraq more than 2 years ago. The team was injured in an airstrike. The prosecution said Gallagher proved his own guilt with photos and text messages, including one in which he allegedly bragged, "Got him with my hunting knife." But in a stunning twist, another medic who was granted immunity told the court he killed the prisoner by holding his thumb over his tracheal tube until he quit breathing.
This should never have gotten to a trial the way that it did.
Defense lawyers call the case a mutiny led by junior SEALs trying to oust a demanding chief.
What the Navy needs to learn is that before they charge somebody, they do a proper investigation.
Andrea Gallagher says her husband's case raises fundamental questions about the military justice system.
I think that this vindication, I hope, will be a lesson learned to everybody that we need to uphold innocent until proven guilty, due process, and we need to afford the benefit of the doubt to our war heroes who we send over there to fight these evils.
Jonathan Vigliotti, CBS News, San Diego.
Gallagher was sentenced, however, to posing with a corpse and demoted. A man stabbed 3 people at a Virginia medical clinic while people were donating blood there Thursday.
Hospitals are treating at least 3 victims of a stabbing at the Octapharma Plasma Center in Petersburg, Virginia, about a half hour south of Richmond. One of the people is in critical condition, Police Lieutenant Dustin Sloan.
A gentleman entered the business with a cutting instrument.
As far as I know, business was usual. Patrons were inside donating blood as any other day.
An unidentified man has been taken into custody in connection with the 4th of July late afternoon incident. Jim Crisula, CBS News.
Coming up, what's next for Hong Kong following mass protests? That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Hong Kong police have announced the arrests of more than a dozen people following mass protests there Monday.
Hundreds of young, angry protesters broke into Hong Kong's legislature Monday, spray-painting anti-government slogans on walls and defacing the city's symbol. They occupy the chamber, demanding to be heard by a government they don't trust. They want their leaders to revoke a contentious extradition bill and for the city's top leader to resign. Their demands that their government revoke a bill that could let Beijing extradite anyone from Hong Kong and for the city's top leader to resign. After midnight, the government acted. Riot police swept the area, firing several rounds of tear gas and clashing with protesters, injuring about 50. In a pre-dawn press conference, Chief Executive Carrie Lam condemned the violence and called for a return to normalcy. But for many, Monday's chaos was the culmination of years of growing anger.
I think it's a wake-up call for both Carrie Lam, but much more so the central government. They need to understand that behind that is something much more fundamental, much of a higher order.
China's Communist Party in Beijing said it stands behind the government here in Hong Kong. Ramy Innocencio, CBS News, Hong Kong.
Iran is testing the patience of the world powers still in its nuclear deal that the U.S. pulled out of last year. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says his country will enrich uranium to any amount it wants. It's raising concerns Iran could have enough of it to build a nuclear weapon. Let's talk with our Pam Falk, who's based at the UN. Pam, how is the UN responding?
The UN is reacting with great concern, trying to keep the parties in the nuclear deal and avoid a confrontation. This is the nuclear deal that the UN codified, and the Secretary General is sending the message that the action Iran is taking would not help preserve the plan, nor any tangible economic benefits, is what he said, for the Iranian people. Now, Iran is playing hardball with the international community and with the U.S. It announced this week that it had breached the 2015 nuclear accord by stockpiling more low-enriched uranium than is permitted. On Wednesday, as you said, Iran's president warned European powers that Tehran will increase its enrichment of uranium to any amount they want. President Trump warned Iran that it was playing with fire because now there is a one-year window that Iran would need to produce enough material for a nuclear bomb, even though Iran says it doesn't want nuclear weapons.
So, Pam, what is the long-term strategy for the U.S. in this crisis?
President Trump wants a new deal, one that includes a ban on ballistic missiles and Iran's aid to proxy groups that threaten Israel, Syria, and Yemen. Iran's president on Wednesday said his advice to the world was to go back to the negotiating table and respect the deal that the UN put into place. This is a dangerous stalemate because Iran's decision to breach the nuclear deal could have far-reaching consequences for diplomatic efforts to resolve the crisis, and when European countries are trying to pull the U.S. and Iran back down from any kind of military confrontation.
Meanwhile, Pam, there's also another crisis unfolding in Libya where dozens of migrants and refugees were killed in an attack on a detention center east of Tripoli. What happened and how is the U.N. Secretary General responding?
And the UN Security Council called an emergency meeting to discuss behind closed doors what to do. Why is it behind closed doors? That is probably because there's not much that Russia and the US can do except to condemn the attacks on civilians. Now, the reason that so many African migrants are in Libya is that they're fleeing poverty and war, trying to reach Italy by boat. And many are picked up, as the UN has agreed to, and brought back to the Libyan Coast Guard, brought back to Libya, and now they've been attacked.
Is this a sign that things could be unraveling in Libya?
This conflict threatens to boost migration, increase migration across the Mediterranean to Europe because the migrants do not want to return to Libya. It may disrupt oil supplies, and it certainly puts a damper on the UN plan for an election to resolve the differences between the parallel governments in the east and the west of Libya.
Conflicts unfolding in North Africa and the Middle East with CBS News Foreign Affairs analyst Pam Falk watching them. An historic meeting between Pope Francis and Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Vatican.
Amid heavy security in Rome, Russian President Vladimir Putin went straight from the airport to the Vatican to meet with Pope Francis, whom he had already met twice before. Putin was 1 hour behind schedule, but Pope Francis gave him a warm handshake as soon as he arrived. No details were immediately made available of their closed-door talks at the Apostolic Palace. The conflict in the Ukraine, though, was expected to be part of their discussions. Sabina Castelfranco, CBS News, Rome.
A new round of tariffs on the EU could make some of your favorite food and drinks more expensive.
The U.S. has long argued that Europe's Airbus has an unfair advantage because it receives improper government subsidies. So the Trump administration is threatening to slap tariffs on some $21 billion worth of European products, including cheese, pasta, and Scotch and Irish whiskeys. Incidentally, the World Trade Organization has previously found that both sides unfairly subsidized their aircraft industries. There may be some kind of WTO ruling on that later this year. Vicky Barker, CBS News at the Foreign Desk in London.
Flooding in Japan.
Japan's Prime Minister Abe promised to work closely and rapidly with local officials coping with the aftermath of a storm that, in just 3 days, dumped a month's worth of rainfall on southwestern Japan. The rain set off dozens of landslides, flooded homes, stopped trains, and broke windows. Heavy rains have moved east, threatening Tokyo and surrounding areas through the weekend. Lucy Kraft, CBS News, Tokyo.
A big step Tuesday on our way back to the moon 50 years after Apollo 11. Here's CBS News correspondent Peter King.
The launch of an Orion spacecraft mock-up from Cape Canaveral went perfectly. 55 seconds later, its launch escape motors pulled the spacecraft away from the rocket.
Pyros 3 and 4, discharge.
Flight controllers were delighted, as was Orion program manager Mark Kirisich.
By all accounts, it was magnificent.
NASA ships are out in the Atlantic recovering a dozen flight data recorders, and if that data looks good, space agency hopes to fly an unpiloted Orion ship next year, followed by a crewed mission in 2022. Peter King, CBS News, Orlando.
Up next, the charm school for new U.S. ambassadors.
You're in class from 8 in the morning till 6 at night every day.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Sunday nights, Monday mornings, or Tuesday afternoons. You can listen to 60 Minutes whenever you want with the weekly podcast from CBS News.
How many drugs are we talking about?
Hundreds.
With hard-hitting investigative reports, interviews, and profiles.
Did these documents that you got prove corruption?
Oh, absolutely.
From a variety of CBS News correspondents and contributors.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
I'm Bill Whitaker.
For the biggest scoops and the best storytelling, subscribe to the 60 Minutes podcast today.
From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Police say seven Americans were killed in a July 4th helicopter crash in the Bahamas shortly after takeoff.
It was heading from one of the Bahamas' northernmost islands to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on the 4th of July. Authorities found the helicopter submerged in 16 feet of water after learning it did not arrive at its destination. Self-made billionaire Chris Klein is among the victims. One of his daughters was reportedly on the plane with him. Klein was a well-known philanthropist in his native West Virginia. According to Forbes, he joined the family coal business at a young age and began working in underground mines at just 15 years old. He later developed some of the most productive and economical coal mines in the United States. Bloomberg called him the new King Coal. On Thursday night, West Virginia's Governor Jim Justice said on Twitter that he lost a very close friend and that Klein was always there to give. What a wonderful, loving, and giving man.
Correspondent David Begno reporting. After building a successful career in philanthropy, Susan Lewis Solomon uprooted her life to move to Europe with her husband Alan as he began a 3.5-year post in Spain as the U.S. ambassador there based in Madrid under former President Obama. Susan is out with a new book about her experience called Lost and Found in Spain, Tales of an Ambassador's Wife. Thanks for joining us, Susan.
Thanks for having me, Steve. It's my pleasure.
If you'll forgive me, I want to start with what may be a challenging question for you, Susan. You write in your book that you got word from the White House in January 2009 about its offer to your husband to serve as ambassador after you and he had worked on the Obama campaign helping secure donations. Politico reported in 2009 your husband helped raise $500,000 for the Obama campaign. Some Democratic presidential candidates, including Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, have pledged they won't appoint donors as ambassadors. Do you think that's fair?
Well, let me say that In the Foreign Service, there are two types of ambassadors. There are career diplomats, those who have worked in the Foreign Service their entire career or most of their career, and those that are non-career. And my husband was non-career. And I would argue that he brought, and so do other non-career ambassadors, they bring a range of skills and talents that really is very, very helpful to the Foreign Service and to our diplomatic efforts abroad. So I would say that it's really worthwhile to have skilled, knowledgeable, smart, non-career ambassadors. And President Obama appointed many of those.
As you and your husband were being introduced into this new career, essentially, you mentioned in your book how you went to a sort of ambassador school. Can you explain that?
Sure. Every ambassador, whether they're career or non-career, go through an intensive two-week training program run at the State Department. It's down in Washington. We happen to have gone in July of 2009. It's two solid weeks where you are trained in every aspect of our State Department, our government, even things that you think you already know. And then you learn the intricacies of what the mission is about. In our case, it was about Spain and Andorra. You learn about the residence, the household, the structure of the embassy. It's intense.
And it was also a sort of charm school.
Well, it's referred to that way. Trust me, and I write this in my book, there is nothing charming about it. You're in class from 8 in the morning till 6 at night every day. And there's a parade of, you know, whether it be from security to the FBI to, Homeland Security, the military, they're coming and talking to you about what the role of the embassy will be with their particular missions as well within the government.
This ambassadorship also had an effect on you personally. Can you kind of explain that?
So I have always had my own career. Alan had a huge job description as ambassador. And ambassador's spouse or partner comes with no job description. And as a matter of fact, the ethics department within the Department of State said to me, your work, which was in the philanthropic sector, might pose a conflict of interest, and we don't think you should bring your work. So I had to forge a role for myself. And I would say most women or men who are coming in to the State Department these days all have had careers, and we want to play meaningful roles. And ultimately, I was able to create programs that connected Spanish women with the embassy, shine a light on what they were doing, open our embassy doors, create new friendships and relationships for our economic departments, our commercial services area. And all of this parlayed in a very, very meaningful way.
You also discuss, Susan, about sharing American values as part of your purpose in Spain, including volunteering. Why was that a unique experience?
Well, in Spain, the government and the church had always helped to take care of, let's say, the homeless population, the social service agencies, the hospitals. There was a very, very strong network that the government and the church in particular in Spain provided. And when we were there, it was during an economic crisis. And the response from the government and the religious sector was not as strong. So we started a volunteer program, and it was for embassy people to participate. It was on a total voluntary basis. And we went out. We went to senior citizens' home. We went to playgrounds. We went to hospitals. We rolled up our sleeves and did what was needed. And we were very proud of this effort. And the Spanish staff who worked at the embassy, all embassies have locally employed staff, people who continue working in the embassy year after year. The local Spanish population loved volunteering, and they have continued to do it long after we have left Spain. We've been gone now 6 years, believe it or not.
Lost and Found in Spain by Susan Lewis-Solomon. Great talking with you, and safe travels, Susan, to wherever your next trip takes you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate having the conversation with you. Have a great weekend.
Another person who served his country, former NYPD Detective Luis Alvarez, who was laid to rest Wednesday. He was one of the 9/11 first responders sickened after the attack years later. He died last Saturday after spending his final weeks fighting Congress for health care benefits for other 9/11 first responders. WCBS radio reporter Peter Haskell was at his funeral.
In its final hours, Alvarez was thinking of others. He woke up agitated, telling his sister Ida he'd been walking. He was asked where.
My brother responded, "I was walking to find first responders to make sure they get help."
His family says Alvarez leaned on his faith and he was at peace. Peter Haskell for CBS News, Astoria, New York.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, the uproar over scrapped plans for new Nike sneakers.
Nike set off a firestorm after pulling their shoes emblazoned with the Betsy Ross flag.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
A political uproar over Nike's decision to abandon sneakers featuring an early version of the American flag this Independence Day.
Nike set off a firestorm after pulling their shoes emblazoned with the Betsy Ross flag, an early version of the American flag with 13 stars and stripes used in the 1700s before slavery was abolished.
When you look at that early version of the American flag, what does it symbolize?
Well, it symbolizes, I see it, I see the colonies, and that leads directly to slavery.
In some cases, the Betsy Ross flag has been co-opted by white supremacist groups like the KKK. Conservatives lashed out against Nike. Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas wrote, "It's a good thing Nike only wants to sell sneakers to people who hate the American flag." Arizona's Republican Governor Doug Ducey withdrew all financial incentives the state promised Nike to invest in a $185 million factory in Arizona. He tweeted, "Nike has apparently decided that Betsy Ross is unworthy and has bowed to the current onslaught of political correctness and historical revisionism." And former Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain tweeted, "Nothing can happen in America anymore if Colin Kaepernick doesn't like it."
Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
Former NFL star Colin Kaepernick is the face of Nike's Just Do It campaign. He reportedly complained to Nike the flag is an offensive symbol of slavery.
This is a great teaching moment, and it brings us in contact with a history that most of us, and most Americans, do not want to deal with.
In a statement, Nike doesn't mention Kaepernick, but says they made the decision to halt distribution based on concerns that it could unintentionally offend and detract from the nation's patriotic holiday. Meg Oliver, CBS News, New York.
The Los Angeles Angels are remembering pitcher Tyler Skaggs. The 27-year-old was found dead Monday in a hotel room near Dallas before his team was due to play the Rangers.
Lost a teammate, lost a friend, a brother.
Angels slugger Mike Trout fought through tears as he reflected on the loss of Tyler Skaggs.
To lose, you know, somebody like him, it's tough.
The Angels hung Skaggs' number 45 jersey in their dugout during Tuesday's game.
We wanted to, you know, take him out there with us, you know, one more time.
Tributes to Skaggs poured in from around the baseball world, from the Cleveland Indians' Trevor Bauer,
marking the initials of his former teammate,
to Skaggs' best friend, Washington Nationals pitcher Patrick Corbin, who wore Skaggs' number 45. The two players were drafted together in 2009.
He was in my wedding this offseason. He's just all I'm thinking about.
Back in Texas, Angels fans honored Skaggs off the field, some marking their own ball caps with TS45.
We all grieve as a family, yeah. And wearing this hat means being part of the Angels family.
And when teammate Cole Calhoun hit a homer in the eighth, he pointed up to the sky as he crossed home plate.
We know we got an angel watching over us now. And he was a guy that lit up the room.
The whole team and coaching staff lined up to hug each player as they walked off the field. The Angels will wear a 45 on their jerseys for the rest of the season, and they plan to honor Skaggs again when they get home to Angel Stadium next week. Though it could be weeks before we learn the cause of Skaggs' death. Carter Evans, CBS News, Arlington, Texas.
It was a dramatic win for the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team at the World Cup against England as the team eyes a final game against the Netherlands.
Rojas. Done!
The first goal came fast and early for the U.S., but soon England got even.
Drives it from wide. Goal!
Then U.S. co-captain Alex Morgan pushed her team ahead again.
Goal!
Celebrating as if she were taking a sip of the most British of beverages, tea. After rough plays, tons of tension.
Houghton shot, save!
And this crucial save by goalie Alyssa Nayer on a penalty kick, Team USA handed its fans another victory.
Two quality teams, first-class teams. It could have gone, you know, either way at times in the game.
I'm, like, getting emotional. It means everything. I mean, as someone who, like, I played soccer all my life, so watching my heroes, like, live, fulfill my dream is unreal.
Correspondent Roxana Saberi reporting from Lyon, France. The next frontier of NFL recruiting, the UK. Correspondent Ian Lee explains.
16-year-old Tashane Boyce didn't know much about American football a few months ago, but now he's chasing his dream of becoming a wide receiver.
I really like the game. It's kind of similar to rugby in some ways.
He's one of more than 1,500 British teens who applied for the UK's new NFL Academy. But only 80 of the strongest, fastest, most agile will win a spot at the elite school.
This is where, like, I get to show them what I can do.
The Academy hopes to give British kids not only a shot at the NFL, but a path to college as well.
That's what we're trying to mirror here, high school football, right down from academics to high school environment.
Go! Go, New Paco!
It's one more way the NFL is trying to grow the game across the pond. Teams have been playing in front of UK crowds for more than a decade.
Ooh.
English NFL stars like F.A. Obada are a big inspiration for these kids.
Obada!
4 years ago, the Carolina Panthers defensive end had never played the sport. He was homeless and caught up in gangs until football changed his life.
It just reminded me of myself when I was younger.
To have someone that's so big and known out there that's done it and has experience helping me, it's a big feeling that I feel happy.
A game-changing experience the NFL hopes will give kids a future both on and off the field.
Finish!
Ian Lee, CBS News, London.
One news organization is making big progress on pay equity.
The BBC says it's turned the corner on closing its gender pay gap. 2 years ago, 75% of the BBC staffers paid nearly $190,000 were men. All of the top 10 earners were men. Now the news organization says three women are among its top 10 paid stars. Pay for top talent has gone from a 75-25 split between men and women to 55-45. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
TV actor and comedian Artie Johnson has died following a long illness.
Very interesting.
Artie Johnson made a name for himself on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In as the befuddled German soldier who thought the war was still on. And as Tyrone F. Horny, the dirty old man on the park bench.
How would you like to come to my waiting arms?
Johnson also made guest appearances on many TV shows, including Bewitched, Lost in Space, and The Partridge Family. The 5'4" actor never saw his height as a disadvantage.
If a bomb ever drops, you can get to the furthest point back in the cave, so you'll survive longer than everybody else.
Artie Johnson was 90. Bill Rakoff, CBS News.
Coming up, the end of an era.
The company that runs Mad Magazine says it'll no longer be available on newsstands starting this fall and will only be reprinting old material from then on.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Every Sunday, Face the Nation brings you in-depth interviews with the biggest names in Washington.
Kellyanne Conway, Nancy Pelosi, Lindsey Graham, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
You'll never miss an episode with the weekly podcast from CBS News Radio. Tune in to hear moderator Margaret Brennan and the country's top policymakers discuss today's toughest issues.
What is going on? Is this political conspiracy or is this just incompetence?
The Face the Nation podcast. Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
A tribute this weekend to a magazine gone mad.
The company that runs Mad Magazine says it'll no longer be available on newsstands starting this fall and will only be reprinting old material from then on. Mad has been published for 67 years. In my day, it sometimes included flimsy records you could put on your turntable to really annoy your parents. Mad's late publisher and demented genius William Gaines once said Mad performed a public service.
I also hope that a lot of kids have learned to take everything they read with a grain of salt, or maybe a ton of salt.
A world without Mad. What, me worry? Well, yeah, a little. Sam Litzinger, CBS News.
Leaving Texas, 4th day of July.
Many of us are enjoying some outdoor concerts on this long holiday weekend, and many of those productions are borrowing a few things from the Grateful Dead. Our Gautier Giacomoni joins us on the line from New York. Gautier, you produced the new CBS News Radio audio documentary, Dead Sound, The Grateful Dead, and the Evolution of Modern Concert Sound. How has that band's sound impacted how we experience live music?
Several ways. When they started in the late 60s, there was little to no knowledge as to how to really put on a good concert that would sound good. They were using technology that was invented in the 20s by movie studios. And that's not conducive to multiple instruments all coming out of the same speakers. Stuff would get distorted. You couldn't go really loud, which a lot of rock and roll people like to do. So very early on, they started tinkering and trying stuff out and figuring out how they could improve their sounds. And over the years, that really impacted how the rest of the concert industry put their own concerts together.
And one of the first things they did was turn back to the movie industry, specifically movie theaters. What did they do?
So they had this engineer who was a visionary and a character, and he figured out that, you know, the best speakers available right now are in movie theaters. Why don't we get some old movie theater speakers, bring them out with us on gigs, and that'll give us the best quality available.
One of the challenges, especially for any band that plays a huge venue like a stadium, is how to have an experience that's equal to, or at least as best as they can, replicate the first row with the back row. How much thought and consideration did they give that?
A lot. So over the years, they've worked with several audio engineers. And one of them actually told me that was his goal when very early on, was to take a rock band and make it so that no matter where you were in the venue, it was as good as if you were sitting in your living room in front of your stereo with the audio cranked all the way up. And so they figured out how they could reduce the amount of echo and feedback and bounce back they were getting from the rooms. And that way, no matter where you sat, you would get the same audio.
What about technology then? Did they develop any new sound tools or algorithms that really have led to what we hear today?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. There's several things that they've come up with, and one of them was to be able to measure the audio coming in and out and bouncing back to them from their own speaker. They took this one device and they used it in such a way that they were then able to measure audio bouncing around in different frequencies, bouncing around the rooms. And that's become a standard piece of equipment now. Whenever concert venues are built, they use this device, or at least the updated version of this device, to do very much the same thing that the Grateful Dead were doing back in the mid-70s, if not earlier.
The Grateful Dead's impact on how we experience concerts. CBS News Radio's Gautier Giacomoni on Dead Sound. Thanks, Gautier.
Thank you.
You might also be at the beach this weekend if you're on Cape Cod. Local authorities there are reporting an increase in shark sightings.
These vehicles are part of the fast response plan for you.
Exactly.
Orleans Fire Chief Anthony Pike's job is protecting parts of this 40-mile stretch of coastline from a danger you can't always see. Sharks.
Do you think people are afraid, or do you think they just accept that this is now part of life here?
I think that we're undergoing a culture change here.
Pike says it's the new normal. Over the past 8 years, at least three people have reportedly been bitten by sharks on the Cape, and shark sightings prompted the Cape Cod National Seashore to ban water entry, a reported 28 times last year. That means boosting emergency response, more landlines to combat poor cell service, shark warning signs, and beachside emergency boxes.
The first aid box
of its kind in the coastal United States. Tourniquets, eye protection, gloves, trauma dressings. If you access this box, you have a pretty good cache of what you may need in a major emergency.
They are following the food, and the food, unfortunately, is very close to shore, and we are very close to shore.
Massachusetts marine biologist Greg Scomel, whose team tagged three great whites in the past few days here, says the exploding seal population is the reason for the increase in shark sightings.
I asked people if you're going to be in an area where these sharks are hunting, and that's particularly along the Outer Cape, parts of Cape Cod Bay as well. This is a natural hunting ground for this species. And take into consideration the fact that you are a land animal going in the ocean, and be vigilant.
The seal population here is protected by law, and while it might seem like shark sightings off Cape Cod are a common occurrence, being killed by one is very rare. In fact, statistically, you have a better chance of being killed by a lightning strike, a car accident, or even a dog. Don Daler, CBS News, Wellfleet, Massachusetts.
Here's another Independence Day tradition.
Nobody's stomach has lasted as long as Joey's. It's a dirty dozen for Chestnut.
Joey Chestnut did it again. Chestnut eating 71 hot dogs and buns, taking his 12th title at Nathan's famous annual July 4th hot dog eating contest. That event carried on ESPN2 from Coney Island in Brooklyn, New York. Finally this weekend, an Independence Day history lesson about our flag from correspondent Deborah Rodriguez.
Our flag is one of the prominent symbols of American identity and pride. So have you ever wondered why the Stars and Stripes has the same colors as the British Union Jack, the country we rebelled against? Smithsonian Museum historian Anthea Hartig.
There's a certain kind of both alignment and patriotism when you take the older colors and make your own design.
There's also a practical reason.
The dyes of indigo and cochineal, blue and red, were the easiest dyes to get the deepest colors.
Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. John Whitley is the technical supervisor. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.